Oh, in the first hour, you hear that music, and you know on a Tuesday, it's time to check in with our friends over at SalesportTalk.com, specifically Karen Lyle, who joins me from her home in the East Bay for the last week. We'll do it in studio next week. How are you doing, Karen?
I'm doing great, Rick. Just been out sailing on Sunday with 60 boats on the parade in front of the city, and I'm back ready to talk Salesport Talk.
Yeah, before we get into our first guest, what was that? It looked like there was a small naval battle going on.
Well, you remember Eric Jones, who came in last week in his boat Sea Valor. He was the committee boat, and so we went, and all of the boats paraded along the San Francisco front for the 2021 San Francisco opening day on the bay, and it was a physical event. There were about 60 boats, including the Matthew Turner, which is 100-something tall ship, and the fire boat started it out with the water spewing out and showing us how they put out fires. It was really quite awesome.
All right, very well. Let's check in with our first guest. We're happy to have him. It is Johnny Burke. He's an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, and his films have shown in festivals worldwide, makes very inspiring documentaries with interesting characters, and his most recent film called Lost at Sea did win a prize in Banff at the 18th International Ocean Film Festival. Johnny, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit more about Lost at Sea, what's it's about, and how you got the idea for it, please.
Great. Thanks very much for having you on. I'm speaking from London in England, so I feel very far away from you, but it's nice to feel close to the festival by having a bit of radio coverage, so thanks for that. Lost at Sea is one of those films that, in a way, it's really a chance to give what I would call a forgotten sporting hero their chance to be remembered. So I think the film is about Peter Bird, who was a rower in the 80s and 90s. And he was trying to be the first person to row across the Pacific Ocean in both directions. And actually, he would set out from San Francisco and he would try and reach Australia. And then on a few other occasions, he would set out from Russia and he was attempting to come back to San Francisco. So that was his route. And what happened really is that Peter had a son called Louis. And unfortunately, Peter died at sea in 1996. And Louis and his mum, Polly, they kept hold of all of Peter's amazing video archive and radio audio archive. And they had it kind of kept in their attic for about 25 years. And no one had seen it and no one knew about it. And Peter and his achievements had been forgotten. And then what happened is Louis came to the production company that I was working with called Renegade Pictures. And he said, we've got this incredible footage, this incredible archive. And we got it all converted and we looked at it. And it truly was a kind of an incredible moment of opening up the box and finding this stuff that's been sat in an attic for 25, 30 years. And that archive is really the basis of the film.
Well, Johnny, that is an amazing story. I looked at the trailer, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the film. I guess it's being featured in the International Ocean Film Festival in San Francisco. And mm-hmm. you're calling into our studio in San Francisco, but we broadcast to 168 countries. So we also broadcast to London, and you can catch us over there on TuneIn. Radio on the Sports Byline channel and also on the American Forces Network, which has, I think, about 500 radio stations throughout the world. But I have a question for you about having to go through all this footage and make a story out of it. There was so much material. What was your guiding factor to help you kind of pull this together into a documentary?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I mean, with all films, there's always the challenge about what is the story that you want to tell. And one of the things with this film is that Louis Bird, Peter's son, was intimately involved with the filmmaking process. And Louis and I worked incredibly closely together. And we talked a great deal. And the executive producer, Alex Cook, we all talked a great deal about what the film was really about. And one of the things straight away we said is that, you know, in a way, this film isn't really about rowing. The film's really about adventure and risk. And the dangers of taking, you know, of leading an adventurous life. And then also, what are the kind of knock-on consequences of that? So I think the film is, I think watching people row in a film could get quite boring because it's a very repetitive sport and it takes a very, very long time to cross an ocean. So there was a huge amount of rushes of material of Peter just sat on his boat rowing endlessly. And we realized that wasn't going to make an exciting film. But what does really make an exciting film is realizing that, in a way, the film charts Peter's journey from being a young man where he sets out rowing in the 70s and he doesn't have a family, he doesn't have a partner, he's very free, and he sets off on this incredible adventure. And then gradually as he gets older, he has a partner and he has a child. And then the questions about whether you lead an adventurous life become much more complex, because then you have responsibilities on your shoulders to earn a living and to be there for your family. And so I think the real heart of the film for us, or from very early on, was really this big question about the balance between the search for adventure and the search for responsibility, or a choice of responsibility. And that was obviously seen through Louis Bird's life story, which is obviously when his dad died, Louis was only 4 years old. And that, I think Louis spent his life trying to find his dad, trying to understand who his dad was, and in a way, why did he leave him? And so one of the incredible things in the film is that Louis then goes on his own ocean row and tries to understand his father by going out to sea and experiencing what it's like to be out at sea.
It's very poignant. May I ask, Johnny, what area of London are you in right now?
I don't know if you know it very well. I'm in South London, an area called Clapham.
Yes, Clapham Junction there with all the trains. I do know. And I also wanted to ask you, I know you did the film about the World Naked Bike Ride in London, which is really more of a protest than an exhibition, isn't it?
That's right. I don't know if it's an event. You guys have it in the States, don't you, as well? It's all over the world now. When I did it back in 2005, I filmed it. It was really the early days of that movement. And so the cyclists were very brave because there weren't very many of them. And obviously there's safety in numbers, I think, if you're doing a naked bike ride. And these guys, famously in Sao Paulo, there was a ride with only two people in. Which means you have to be very brave. I've always been interested in unusual films and unusual stories. And I think in a way, the Naked Bike Ride was quite an unusual story at the time. But I feel like it was the people doing it, their hearts were in the right place, and they're trying to make a difference. And the issues that they were protesting at the time, which is oil dependency, they only become more and more pertinent, those issues, with every passing day.
Well, and Johnny, what appealed to you about the water and the experience on the Pacific Ocean in this Lost at Sea as you were uncovering this story from the documentary footage?
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally not a great adventurer. I'm more of a landlubber, I'd be called. So I personally had only, apart from being out in a small sailing boat as a kid, I'd never really spent much time on the sea, but I've always had a love of the sea, and I think really it was in some ways it was for me helping Louis go through a journey. So for me as the director, I felt like part of my role was not just to tell the story, but was also to help Louis, who was still feeling a great deal of grief at the death of his father, to help guide him through the stages of grieving and beginning to heal. And I think so in a way it was having a very delicate touch with the material and with the story, and allowing the story to be told in a very truthful way, and allowing Louis his voice in the film. Because Louis in a way has a very interesting thing. He says on the one hand his father is his hero, but on the other hand, he's desperately sad that his father went to sea and ultimately died. And I think that contradiction, those two contradictory things are right at the heart of the film. And I hope, from what I know from speaking to Louis, he did find the process of making the film a cathartic experience.
Good stuff from Johnny Burke, award-winning filmmaker. Remember, the film is called Lost at Sea. at the 18th International Ocean Film Festival. By the way, if you go to intloceanfilmfest.org, you can check it out for more information. Johnny, congratulations on the film. Thanks for joining us, and hopefully we'll catch up on your next one.
Cheers. Thanks very much. Take care.
And Karen, you've never been lost at sea, have you?
Oh, I've been lost in a marina trying to find my slip. But, you know, if you do have times. I've had times where there's been equipment failures and you're out in the middle of the ocean. And so then you have to figure out how to triangulate or, you know, if you don't see land, then that's kind of difficult. But as long as there's land, you can find your way. You know, it is just always a challenge because there is that thin edge between adventure and excitement and also loss where you know something's really gone wrong.
Yeah. What's the poem? You just need a star to steer her by. Rick Tittle and Karen Lyle, more sailing on the other side. Come on back. I wonder if my parents will ever be apart. My mommy job is a knife. I thrill to see her and daddy's wife. And daddy swims a gun.
I'm calling on the element. Oh, water to say.
Of Sailsport Talk, I'm with Leah Jones to talk about the music video of her song Under Sail, which was shot on my boat Sandpiper on the San Francisco Bay.
Well, the song that you recorded was beautiful. You composed that song. Can you tell us a little bit about the inspiration?
Well, the inspiration comes from absolute devastation of losing one of my best friends, Captain Robert McCreary. There's a nice dedication for him at the very end of the video that we shot on your boat. But Captain Bob, or I called him Bobby, was one of my best friends, and we've known each other since college, and we spent more time on the bay than we did on land. And when he passed away in 2018, I wanted to write a song that would matter to his friends and family, and we had his memorial on Angel Island, and I got to sing that for the first time a couple years ago.
Here is Jeff DeSera, the vocalist and guitarist.
Jeff, tell us what that experience was like for you, sailing and singing and putting that all together.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was a lot of fun, you know, putting the song together and then planning the video shoot. It was just a beautiful day on the bay. It was just such a wonderful experience. Dan, the filmmaker, was very professional. He got some great footage of the trip out. We even captured some drone footage.
Thanks, Jeff. Here is Dan Folds, the videographer.
Tell us a little bit about the experience of filming on the boat.
The experience out filming on the boat was interesting. It's definitely a challenging environment, being such a small space. And if you're focused too much on the camera and take a wrong step, you could end up in the water. So it's definitely a different environment that I'm used to working in. But the challenge was fun, and we captured, I think, a lot of good imagery that kind of encapsulated the story of Captain Robert and of Leah's song, of the music-making process, too.
Thanks, Dan. Here is the saxophone player, Mark Costanzo.
Now, you didn't actually get to come sailing with us, but where did the video take place of your saxophone? Because it was overlaid into the video, and it was just lovely. I loved the visuals on that.
Yeah, thank you. Well, there's a park. I think it's called Cesar Chavez Park, right at the Berkeley Marina. So that's where we decided to meet. That's where they met, actually, to go on the boat as well. But we met, and from there, we did a lot of video, and it was really nice because we're right on the berm, right at the rock wall of the bay. So really good shots of boats and the rest of the bay behind us. It was a perfect spot, and it was a gorgeous day.
See Leah Jones' video on SailsportTalk.com. That's SailsportTalk.com.
All right, thank you for that, and welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle and Karen Lyle on behalf of SailsportTalk.com, and there's the Piano Finders call-in line if you'd like to call up at 800-878-PLAY. Lauren Ann Smith is our guest, and we're trying to get a hold of her right now. Until then, Karen, you mentioned, bringing your boat into the slip. Just for fun, for people like me that don't know, how much does it cost to, rent one of those things for a year? Because I would imagine it would probably be extremely high.
You know, it depends upon the marina and where you are. Here in the Bay Area, and it depends on the size. You usually charge by foot, and so it might be under a couple hundred dollars, and it might be, I think from my boat, it's a 36-foot boat. I'm paying, around $500, a little bit under $500 per month for the, they call it berthing fees. And, we joke a bit about owning a boat because you have boat units. We call a boat unit is $1,000. It's how much you spend when you start doing repairs, right? So instead of saying the amount of money, we'll say it was like, five boat units, right? But, it does cost a bit to upkeep it. But there are many people who go into partnerships, and then they will have maybe three or five people who co-own a boat together and share the expenses. And, or there's boats that belong to nonprofits, and people will join those nonprofits and they'll volunteer labor. And there's all different kinds of ways of being able to get out there on the water, even on small boats like rowboats we were just talking about.
You sound well now, but at the beginning of that, you were cutting in and out, so I didn't really get what you were saying. Did you say, how much did you say it was?
Oh, I'm sorry. So somewhere, for my boat, about $483 per month. And then a lot of times people will partner up and share expenses.
I gotcha. So yeah, about right around $500 a month then.
Well, that's for a larger boat, and smaller boats would be a couple hundred.
But aren't the berthing areas basically all the same size?
No, they're different sizes. They're called slips, and so you get a slip that's approximately the size of your boat. And of course, if you've got a 100-foot boat, then you're going to usually be on an end tie, which is the very end of the finger, they call it, which is where all the slips are located on either side, upwind or downwind. And at the very end, there's a long space, and that's called the end tie.
So I always wondered too, because obviously once you get to the marina and you're trying to find your slip, you're going with your outboard or your inboard motor. But if you don't have one of those, do you just got to pull all your sails down and row in, because you can't rely on the wind to get you right exactly into that slip, right?
Well, you can. There you can manipulate your boat around. Usually you might leave your jib up, or the jib is the forward sail if you have what's called a sloop, which is, has a mainsail and a jib, or you might sail by mainsail, and then you have to drop the sail at a certain point. But I certainly have sailed into a dock. You can sail. You just have to you have to manipulate it around, and if you happen to be going straight into the wind, you're not going to have the ability to go to have power that way. So you'll probably have to angle, and you might have to use some lines to pull yourself in if you didn't get in exactly at the right way. So there's lines of the ropes that we call lines are the name that you use for working ropes on a boat. So if you're using them in some way, they're called a line.
Well, I remember it was, I don't know, maybe a year or two ago, the Larkspur Ferry, of which I have taken many times, came into the Embarcadero and slammed right into the cement. So even with the pilot going outside, so it's still not an exact science at times, right?
Well, I haven't slammed into a slip since I was a beginner, but I did it when I was a beginner. And that's usually what happens is, and here I am telling everybody, but I'm an accomplished sailor now. I can tell my stories of when I wasn't. but if it's too close, then you don't feel you don't feel like joking about it. It's always, you always need a little distance, hopefully years,
Yeah. It's Rick Tittle with Karen Lyle, 1-800-878-PLAY. What would be, in your opinion, because I know people who have, you know, sailed from San Francisco to Asia. What would be something in your mind that just sounds way too dangerous and way too stupid? Or are you the type of person that like embraces all, you know, all sorts of nautical endeavors?
Well, I embrace others' nautical endeavors of any kind. In other words, what a person is willing to do for their own benefit or sense of adventure or to prove a point or to accomplish something, I celebrate, and that's one of the reasons I enjoy, you know, being a co-host on the show and putting together the Sail Sport Talk is because I get to interview these people who have such a passion for what they do. Personally, I would say that, you know, I don't do things just strictly for the sake of adventure or to do them, and I'm not somebody who craves that razor edge feeling of just being on the edge of fear, you know, that is the other side of the adventure. I tend to be willing to put up with weather and with all of those things, and I will exhibit courage, you know, in the midst of fear, but I'm not seeking it. So it's more something that can happen. But usually I think that I'm more of the idea that a good ship handler is somebody who doesn't put themselves in a situation where you need a good ship handler. and so I do things like watch the weather and look at the tides and currents and kind of know my limits as to how many foot swells I want to deal with. And even with all that planning, you're going to find yourself in some situation that you didn't expect, but you can mitigate it by paying attention to what's happening. So, and that's because I'm also close to shore and I'm not on a circumnavigation of the globe as many of our sailors that we've been talking to. And I'm not racing, you know, with other people who might hit me like happened at SailGP this last, we'll be talking about that coming up with Christopher next time.
You know, it's interesting too, the old sayings, you know, red skies at night, sailors delight, red skies in morning, sailors take warning. Can you get out on the water, even with like a small craft advisory, but can you get out there, look around, feel the wind, look at the chops, and know exactly what you're getting into? Or is that sort of you can't?
Yes. Well, there are several things that you look. First of all, you can usually tell the direction of the wind by turning your face so that you get the wind coming on equal pressure on both sides of your face. And that's one of the ways you can tell. But also, if the wind has been blowing for a bit, it creates little bubble trails along the top or surface of the water. And you can look at the bubble trails, and they might be like maybe 6 inches wide, you know, and you'll see these little bubble trails. Now, that's if the wind is blowing enough, and it has been blowing on the surface of the water, and you can see the direction of the wind from that. You can look at the tide if you're looking at surfaces, say like a seawall, or you're looking at something that stationary, and it's wet above where the water line is. You know that the tide is probably ebb tide, and it's going down. If there's no wet surface above it, then it's probably, on a flood where the tide is going up. There's all kinds of indicators. In your sails, you can look at the shape of the sail. You can look at how, how the wind is flowing. Even though you can't see the wind, you can see how the sail behaves. And you can tell whether you have something called good trim, which is meaning that you're efficiently manipulating the positioning of the sail so that it's approximately 45 degrees to the wind so that you're going to get efficient, propulsion through the water.
What part of sailing would you still have to throw up your hands and say, I don't know about that? You know, if somebody said, here, do this, do that, and you're like, that's something that I'm not very skilled in at this point. What would that be?
You know, I think all of us as sailors would say that we have many areas in which we haven't encountered even the depths of our lack of knowledge.
<You know? laughs> Good answer.
So sometimes, there's certain things I know that I don't know how to do yet. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to sail a foiling catamaran at, you know, 50 knots like the America's Cup guys, you know, and women who sail like that. But it's not what I know that I don't know that worries me. It's what I don't know that I don't know that worries me. Where I think I might know something, and then I discover, oh.
No, that's a very wise answer. One more question for you. You know, we've had so many sailors on over the years and some fantastic solo female sailors as well. What's the farthest you think you could go solo?
Me going solo?
Like Catalina? I mean, what would it be?
You know, I have to say that I'm not a person who would want to sail solo. To circumvent, a double handing is something I enjoy, which means there's another person with me on the boat. And I think the sense of responsibility that you have when you're the captain of the boat, and when anything, especially if it's your boat and you're going to pay for anything that goes wrong, you know, it adds a little layer of concern, or just a sense of responsibility that you can't complete. I can't completely relax in that role. So I find that I enjoy being a first mate to a really good captain, which is the way that I handle my boat. My boat partner has a minority ownership in the boat, but he has a majority of experience above mine. And so I always feel like that when we're out on the boat and we're out sailing, I can relax and really enjoy the experience of doing it, because all of that responsibility isn't just on my shoulders alone. And so that's, you know, it's one of the reasons, hey, I like co-hosting with you, Rick. Because here you have all these more years of experience broadcasting. I know that if something goes wrong and we're not able to connect with our guest who's in Australia at 3:30 in the morning for some reason, that we're going to be able to sit and talk and it's going to work out just fine.
But we have a minute left. Just to answer my question, what would be the farthest you could go solo, do you think?
Well, if I were going to go solo, I would like to be in the Indian Ocean off of Zanzibar and sail around to the different islands there, but not so far as where the pirates are.
I think for me, I could go from Tiburon to Angel Island. That would be about as far as solo. Do the Raccoon Straits.
That would be a good one. And that's really pretty there. I was just in the Raccoon Straits last week. It's very pretty.
All right, Karen Lyle, yeah, it's we didn't have a guest, but who needs guests? Thanks for checking in. Everybody check out SailsportTalk.com, and next week I'll see you in the studio, huh?
Okay, that would be wonderful. I'm looking forward to it.
All right, me too. I'm Rick Tittle, and we'll take a quick break. Come on back on Sports Bio.